That's Shelf Life on Sundays at noon on WJFF Radio Catskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. Has the opioid crisis persisted in part because of shame and stigma?
Sometimes I feel like I'm working in the days of the Salem witch trials.
And do states finally have a chance to end this epidemic?
These settlements are massive. They are multi-billion dollar settlements.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
I'm Callison Stratton, a singer-songwriter, public historian, and host of Liberation Station here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Liberation Station is a show that highlights the work of female and femme-presenting performers across genre and time. It's my little way of balancing the scales of representation on the radio. Join me for Liberation Station every Saturday evening at 7 p.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg, and today my guest is Livingston Manor resident, writer, and transformation guide, John Roynan. You might be wondering, what the heck is a transformation guide? And John's going to tell us about that. But first, we have a lot of ground to cover. In fact, we have a whole ocean. Since John grew up in Great Britain and as a young man came to the U.S. for studies with lots of life-changing experiences in between. So let's get to it. Welcome to Catskill Character, John. I'm so happy to have you here.
Thank you, Donna. I'm so pleased to be here.
How do you like our beautiful new studios?
I love it.
It's really nice, isn't
it?
I'm saying new, but we've been here a while now, but it's just every time I come in, I'm still kind of like, overwhelmed.
It's a lovely facility.
Yeah. I'd love to start off with you telling the listener about growing up in Churchill, which is southwest of Bath, for those of you out there who know anything about Great Britain, and 97 miles west of London.
Churchill is just a small country village, and I grew up on a farm in the village. It was a dairy farm when I was born. And we also grew some crops, some potatoes. We had cattle, we had chickens, a few pigs. And in many ways, it was probably quite idyllic. We had open pasture fields behind the farm, and that was kind of our playground. And I have an older brother and a sister and two cousins that live next door, and that's where we played.
That's nice. And I think you did hay, right?
Yeah, haymaking. Harvesting potatoes. My grandparents on my mother's side were fruit growers, so they had apple orchards and blackcurrant orchards, grew strawberries.
You said something very interesting to me, though, when we first spoke about the class system in England. And I quote, "People like us don't become doctors," which is very different than our attitude here, which is you can be anything if you put your mind to it and you work hard. That is the prevailing wisdom here. The sky's the limit. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a big difference. That was a prevailing attitude where I grew up. It was in the 1960s, and our work was labor. It was labor, and the value, you were valued for the amount of hired labor that you put into a job. Other things, being a doctor, being a lawyer, in some ways was not considered real work.
Ah, that's interesting. Didn't you tell me that your father or your grandfather decided to stop farming? And all the things that you just told us about, doing the hay and having the animals, that wasn't like you weren't running a farm any longer.
That's correct, yeah. When I was about 6 years old, the herd of cattle was sold. We retained the farm and quite a lot of the land, but it was no longer the primary source of income for our family.
So what's interesting also is that you and your siblings recently put the farmhouse up for sale, and it's been in your family for five generations. So I was wondering what that experience has been like, you know, going through five generations of odds and sods, as the British might say. Don't ask me where I picked that up. I have no idea.
No, it's good. Yes, it's been a really interesting process. For some reason, I don't know why the task kind of came to me. I'm the youngest of, I think, 28 grandchildren on that side of the family. And the family originally rented the farm, and then my grandfather bought it in 1926. He has the same name as me. His name was John Roynan. And somehow the last grandchild of 28, I got his name. And here I find myself.
That's wild.
Yeah. And I find myself setting up a temporary desk setup and going through all of his personal papers because my dad just carried on living in the house, had no need to go through the possessions that were in the house that he'd grown up with.
So you're the youngest of 28 grandchildren. You don't live in Great Britain. You don't live in England. But you are the one that's kind of spearheading this whole project of selling the farmhouse. How the heck did that? You think it's because your name is John Roynan?
I don't know. The house came to my siblings and I through my dad, and my siblings and I through this process have kind of each found our role.
Your little niche.
Our little role. Mm-hmm. I have better capabilities handling paperwork, more sort of like legal matters. My brother's great outside with the farm, moving farm machinery, anything to do with practical farming, I leave to him. And my sister, she has her own role as well. She's very good at just maintaining. And so it's really been an interesting process with the passing of my mother some years earlier, now my father. And we've become much closer. We've become a team.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Now, has somebody actually bought the farmhouse already, or are you just preparing?
It's on the market.
Oh, it's on the market. So you're preparing because you don't want to wait until someone comes along and says, yeah, I want to buy it. And you have all this stuff.
Yeah.
Five generations. Wow. Well, you've also written about the chapter of your life through Yarnslingers. I want to just mention that John is one of Yarnslingers' writers and performs regularly. And we're going to talk about it, but I thought it was important for us to go over it because it was really a life-changing event that occurred when you were only 12 years old. Would you share that with us?
Yeah, that was the most significant event probably in my life to date. And it was just an ordinary day. It was a Wednesday evening. It was in late May. I thought it was just a typical day, and then I heard a commotion. I was watching TV, and I went to find out what the commotion was about, and my father gathered up myself, my brother, and my sister, and explained to us that he had discovered that my mother was having an affair. She was upstairs, she was packing a bag, and she was going to be leaving, and that is indeed what happened. She left that night and never returned.
I mean, does a 12-year-old even know what an affair is?
This 12-year-old did.
Okay.
Because I was a big TV watcher. And I was probably watching
Watching Dallas?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Dallas. I was watching things that were, let's say, after 9 p.m.
Oh, my God. Well, this must have been one of the most terrifying and confusing, I didn't want to call it a conversation because you really weren't saying much. Your father was just talking to you, but it must have been so terrifying and confusing for you.
Yes, very confusing, very upsetting, and just left to really, you know, figure out what just happened.
Yeah, it boggles the mind. So I was wondering, did you ever live with your mom again?
No, I didn't, no.
But you remained close with her and you saw her.
Didn't see her that much. By within a year or so, it just came down to meeting her for birthdays. And I only really realized this recently, I never, after that, ever spent a holiday with her.
Oh, yeah. And she was probably like, as most moms or many moms are, the center of the holidays, the baking and the presents and all that stuff. Yeah, so this is a huge change in your life. You did the best you could and you just went on. But of course, it left a mark, as any trauma does on any of us.
Yeah, very much. My father said that for now it's probably best that we don't mention this to anyone outside of the family. And I guess I just took that on board and just didn't speak about it for a long time.
Now, do you think he was hoping she was going to come back, that they were going to have a rapprochement and put the family back together again?
Yeah, I think that he maybe thought that that was a possibility, that this could get resolved, but it never did. But that hearing him say that, in many ways, it was just, okay, well, I'll keep keeping quiet.
So on top of the trauma, then you had to have a secret.
Yeah. So I didn't tell anyone at school what had happened.
And the only people you could talk to about it were your brother and your sister, I guess.
Yeah.
Your father wasn't going to talk anymore, I'm sure.
He was pretty good, actually. Yeah, he was good. It's kind of amazing because obviously he had to step up to raising three children. This is what I find amazing. Through the whole divorce, the separation and divorce process, every time a letter came from his attorney, he would gather us up again in that same room and read the letter to us, what his attorney had said, and explain it to us. He said he wanted us to know exactly what was going on and not to hear something from other sources. You know, so I admire him for that.
Yeah, I do too. And you know what's really great about that? If your father hadn't been so upfront with you, let's say, so many children think, well, what have I done to cause this? And you never had to go through that because you knew that your parents had a problem and your mother had an affair and he kept you up to date with everything. So yeah, that's very, very unusual.
Yeah.
Wow, hats off to him. So your mom went through her own struggles in the course of dealing with medical issues. She had a lot of medical issues. She became addicted to Valium. And I mean, they used to give that stuff out like candy, let's face it. So I think there were a lot of people at that point addicted. And I know you told me she tried to kick it, as they would say, but it was just a lifelong struggle for her.
Yeah, it was the drug that was provided to her as a solution to her problems. And then later in life, it just became the problem. Side effects, physical, as she got older and as the same case for many people on prescription drugs, your body just can't process those substances. And
you take more,
your liver or your kidney, you just can't process it so well, you know, heart palpitations, mm-hmm. there's all sorts of, and she desperately, for many years, was trying to get off of it. She sent me an email one day. It's the damn Valium. I can't live with it, and I can't live without it.
And, of course, now we have the scourge of our nation. Well, I should say one of the scourges of our nation is the huge problem with prescription drugs, benzos, as you said, you know, the oxys, and now the fentanyl. It's like, when are we going to learn?
Yeah.
But we will stop at that point because I think we're going to take a break, okay?
Okay.
That was something for the listener to think about. When are we going to learn? And how are we going to stop this cycle? This is Catskill Character on Radio Catskill. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg, and my guest today is John Roynan. We'll be right back.
Was the most widespread miscarriage of justice in UK history.
Hundreds of post office workers in the UK were prosecuted under mysterious circumstances and largely ignored. until a TV show ignited a fire.
I don't think you can point to a single television drama which has had such a huge impact, both in terms of public anger and then political movement.
It's on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Can two people with different political beliefs still have a meaningful conversation? I'm Ronald Kelson, and I'm working with Radio Catskill on StoryCorps' One Small Step, bringing strangers and our community together, one conversation at a time. We are having conversations in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania all year long, and you should be a part of it. Sign up now at wjffradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Catskill Character. I'm Donna Fellenberg, and I've been speaking today with John Roynan, writer and transformation guide from Livingston Manor, New York. In the first half of the show, John told us about growing up in a small English village in a farmhouse that had been in his family for five generations. Although his father no longer farmed, there were lots of animals. They made hay, they had chickens producing plenty of eggs. It was a rather idyllic life until John's parents split up when he was 12, with no warning. John's father sat his three children down and told them that their mother was having an affair, and he asked her to leave. This shattering event has left John with aftershocks that he works on to this day. So here's more of my conversation with John Roynan. John, we're going to come around to the effects of your parents' breakup in a minute, but first, let's talk about how you came to the U.S. to study.
Yeah, so what brought me to the U.S. is I met my husband, Dan, in Bristol in England. I was living in Bristol at the time. And, just a long story short, we connected. We realized we wanted to be together. He was visiting in England at that time, but living in Cambridge, in Boston, Massachusetts. So 18 months later, after we met, I arrived in Cambridge. We found a place together in Cambridge. And then I applied to Northeastern University, and I went there and studied communication studies.
Oh, I just heard that Northeastern, which I did not know this, they have oodles of money. They just acquired Marymount College. Did you know that?
I did not.
Down in New York City. So that's going to be like the New York campus of Northeastern.
Wow.
Just a little tidbit there.
Yeah.
So you completed a degree in communications, and you were hired by an ad agency whose clients were all big pharma companies in New York City. This might sound great, but it created a personal conflict for you, right?
Yeah, it really came about one day, much later in my mom's life, when things are starting to unravel for her. And I was driving along the highway in New Jersey to a headquarters of a big pharma company for a marketing meeting. And during that drive, I'm trying to make a call to my mother's doctor in England to try and help resolve some issues that are going on for her. And I can't get through, so it's frustrating. I'm trying to wrap it up before I arrive at the meeting. And as I'm driving, I start hyperventilating. It wasn't until sometime later I realized that probably what I experienced was a panic attack. I was still sort of out of sorts when I arrived at the meeting. I didn't attend the meeting. My colleague said, why don't you just go, head home, go and take care of what you need to take care of. So this was kind of a turning point, because what I realized afterwards is the kind of the irony of the situation. Here I was driving to a meeting for a large pharmaceutical company to help them promote a new, hopefully blockbuster drug. Meanwhile, I'm dealing with the after effects of the successful advertising of Valium that actually is not serving people well, particularly my mother. So there was the conflict. And it was after that point that I realized I needed to make some changes. And probably within a year of that, I had left the pharmaceutical marketing role.
That's amazing that you figured it out that quickly. Because having a panic attack is such a frightening thing. That's really quick turnaround that you did. And you made a lot of changes. I think you told me you started looking into alternative healing, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
You got a new job.
Yeah.
What was your new job?
My husband Dan and I had already started a business, a design business, so we decided to take that full time. So that was working with clients on home design projects.
Right. Dan's an architect.
Correct.
Right. And the work that you and he do is residential design. But I loved when you were telling me about how you speak to a client when you're first trying to ascertain what it is exactly they're looking for. Would you share that with the
listener? Sure. Well, my approach was when I was going to the design meetings with Dan, that when we're in the room or rooms where a client is wishing to have the consultation, my approach would be, how do you feel in this room now? And how do you want to feel? And when they identify those two things, so if I'm understanding you correctly, our role here is to take you from feeling, ugh, when you come into this room, to just, ah, when you come into this room. It's exactly how you want it to be. We had an example of a client who would come home, and when she came home from the city, this was in New Jersey, she'd open her door, and she just felt completely kind of deflated, pulled down by her space, and she wanted to just be able to come home and feel supported and be able to relax.
What's the name of your company?
The name of the company is Thrive House.
Thrive House. Oh my God, that's fantastic.
It's primarily focused on Dan's design work. It's thrive-house.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, my husband and I used to live in this big old farmhouse, and there were two staircases, one in the kitchen, and then on the other side of the house, a staircase went down into the living room. And I used to purposely go downstairs the long way into the living room in the morning, because when I would come down, it was like that room quieted me down and kind of put its arms around me. It was so comforting. It kind of reminds me of how you're speaking to your client. How do you want to feel?
Exactly. That's a very good example. One of the questions we often ask clients is, when you open the front door and you step into your home, what is the first thing you or a visitor sees upon entering your home? You want it to be something that's uplifting. Similarly, what's the last thing you see at night before you turn off the light, and the first thing you see in the morning? Again, waking up in the morning, what's something that's going to bring you joy?
That's the thing that we all have to strive for, to have a lot of joy in our life. And if we're joyful, to spread that joy to other people. And our homes are a very big part of that, I've always felt. I'm on the same page.
Yeah, excellent.
I want to talk about your work as a transformation guy, but I also want to mention that you are a Reiki healer and you practice shamanistic drumming. Could you quickly tell us what those two things are?
Yeah, so after the finishing with the pharmaceutical company, as you mentioned, I became interested in alternative healing. So I became certified as a Reiki master. That is very hard to sort of explain exactly what goes on, but it's energy. It's moving energy, basically.
I mean, do you have a patient on a table?
Yes. So if I'm working with someone on one-on-one, they would be on a massage table. Mm. And when you're doing Reiki, that's not physical touch. Your hands really sort of hover about 4 inches above the person's body. It's a very, to the shamanic practicing, the drumming. I met with a shaman in 2010, and it was kind of, it was a one-day workshop. And that, again, was another pivotal day for me. I look back on that as the day of my spiritual awakening. There was just stuff that happened. They shared information with me. And it just felt like they must have been drawing stuff out of the universe, information out of the universe.
Mm.
So anyway, I managed to combine the Reiki and the shamanic practice into shamanic Reiki. So I'm really guided. I feel I'm just guided to know what to do when I'm doing a session.
And when you're doing a transformation work with clients, I'm sure you bring all of this experience that you've had into play to help them to transform whatever it is that they want to transform. It could be something little. It could be something huge.
Yes. Yeah. And usually I work with clients for maybe six sessions. Usually around session four, we do a shamanic Reiki session. That is after we've met already for three or maybe four times and identified things that the person is ready to release, ready to let go of. Could be self-limiting thoughts, beliefs, or behaviors. That's often, you know, what people we've identified they're holding on to. Mm-hmm. Things that maybe served them well in the past, but the role of that thought, belief, or behavior is no longer relevant and maybe standing in the way. So we facilitate a release of it.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I just want to say very quickly that I'm watching you when I go to Yarnslinger's performances. I'm watching you transform the way you handle emotional content in the stories that you're reading. Because up until a certain time, you had a very hard time with it and you would get very emotional, which interferes with you getting your story out. So I've been watching you. This is a transformation for me. This is how I see it. That when you would come to a point in a story that's very emotionally charged, I see you smiling and I see you breathing. And I'm going, look at that man. He's just transforming this whole experience. So good on you, John. You're talking the talk and walking the walk.
Wow. Thank you, Dawn. I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we go, if you could just quickly tell us, how did you and Dan get up to the Catskills?
Yeah, well, that again was all to do with change, transformation. We were living in New Jersey for 17 years in a great little town called Leonia. The reason we had moved there was for work opportunity in New York City. But 17 years later, neither of us were working in the city. And I had a real yearning for a place with land. Mm. I grew up on that farm. That's what I was looking to get back to. So someone told us about this area of the Catskills. We came up, checked it out, and kind of fell in love with it and found a property that just felt right for us. And that delivered us in the Catskills in February of 2020, 1 month before COVID hit. Felt like someone or some power out there moved us to a safe square.
Yeah, because Leonia is very populated. It's a very populated area. And up here, it was, I hate to say it, this sounds so ridiculous, but it was such a great place to be during COVID because, you know, if you could spread out, you could go outside.
Yeah, I felt very fortunate to be here.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm just so happy that you could share all of this with my listeners.
Well, thank you, Donna. This was an absolute pleasure, and I love your show. So it was a real honor. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been Catskill Character with today's guest, John Roynan. John's website is johnroynan.com. Catskill Character is on every Saturday at 10:30, right after Rosie Starr's Farm and Country. Please join me then, except for the last Saturday of the month, when I share the 10:30 time slot with Greg Triggs and his show, Travel with Triggs. This is Radio Catskill. I'm Donna Fellenberg, and I thank you so much for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Aaron Bendish. Join me for Borscht Beat, the Jewish music show on Radio Catskill. Each week I share rare, forgotten, and classic recordings from Jewish musical traditions across multiple generations, from Yiddish folk songs to instrumental klezmer, Yiddish theater, and contemporary performances. It's a grand tour of many musical landscapes. That's Borscht Beat, an hour of Jewish music in the Catskills, Sunday afternoons at 1 on Radio Catskill.
We are moving now.
Electric bikes are everywhere. They are quiet and very fast. Teens ride them on the roads, in bike lanes, but also in places they should not be, like sidewalks and parks.
Look out!
When you ride, wear a helmet. Don't speed. Watch out for pedestrians and cars. New York State and your community have specific rules for electric bikes. Follow them. Go to trafficsafety.ny.gov for more info. A message brought to you by the Governor's Traffic Safety Committee.